In his new book, Gilded Rage, independent journalist and New York Times bestselling author Jacob Silverman delivers a searing expose on the radicalization of Silicon Valley, a peek behind the curtain at the tech and finance billionaires who are using their money and influence to steer a radical political revolution. As he follows men like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel from early days of PayPal and Palo Alto to Washington, D.C., Silverman uncovers a sinister world where moguls preach populist revolt while dismantling the few remaining checks on their influence. This is the book you need to understand our current political moment and how tech and politics have become dangerously intertwined. Gilded Rage is available October 7th from Bloomsbury Continuum. Get your copy wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan, special correspondent for The Nation. It can be tempting to look away from the Supreme Court. The cases are complicated, the traditions archaic, and these days the decisions are almost always devastating and the reasoning often perverse. But alas, the court is too important to ignore, particularly as John Roberts and his five ultra-conservative colleagues have turned it into a rubber stamp for Donald Trump. Luckily, we at The Nation are blessed to have perhaps the only person in America who can make following the Supreme Court not only bearable but entertaining, our inimitable justice correspondent Ellie Mistal. Ellie's annual roundup of the court's biggest upcoming cases is the cover story in our November issue, and I'm delighted that he's with us today to talk about what fresh hell the court has in store. Ellie, welcome back to the Nation Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Don. Yeah, I make it entertaining in a kind of gallows humor kind of way, right?
Well, gallows humor is the only kind of humor for some of us.
the only one we have left, Don.
So here's the thing, Ellie. We'll get down to cases in a minute, but I was discussing this conversation with my daughter, who's a paid-up member of the Ellie Mistal fan club and a very faithful reader of yours. And she said, well, hasn't Ellie said some of this before? And so I said, yes, but there's a reason why he needs to keep saying it. So the part of this that will be familiar to some listeners, but perhaps not to others, and for those who haven't heard this before, you really need to listen up. Why is the Supreme Court not going to save us?
Yeah, so it's actually, that's a great way to start, because I do say a lot of these things often. I do sometimes feel like I am just putting the emphasis on a different syllable every time I take to the keyboard. I think it's particularly important to say it now because the Supreme Court has been marketed as our last line of defense, the last institution that's holding. And that is just not true. If you've been paying attention to these people, not just over the past 18 months since Trump, you know, started his re-election tour de force, but over the past 25 years, this is the 20th year that John Roberts is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. If you've been paying attention to the Roberts Court over the past 20 years, you already know what they're going to do. And what they're going to do is everything in their power to crush democracy, to make sure that rights are taken away from vulnerable people, and yes, to rubber stamp the Trump administration. That's why they're there. That's what they were picked for. And so this idea that the Supreme Court is some kind of somehow going to come in from on high and save us from, and I hate to point this out to people, but a democratically elected president who has control of the House and the Senate, and you think that the unelected, unaccountable justices are going to come in and stop a man who they agree with on policy, who they agree with more often than not, if you think they're going to stop him, you're just out to lunch, man. You just haven't been paying attention to what these people are all about and why they were picked for their jobs.
Well, I want to take you up on a little bit of the end of that, where you said, are they going to stop a democratically elected president who has control of Congress and who they agree with on policy? Those are three different pillars, as it were, in the Supreme Court's inaction. And We can certainly remember the Roberts Court stopping a democratically elected president who had, however thin, control of the Senate and the House from putting into practice his policy ideas. I mean, that...
100%, right? The Supreme Court is why we don't have student debt relief.
Right, and why we didn't get the big Biden, you know, the infrastructure bill.
Yeah, and that's because, but that's because they didn't agree with Biden on policy. And the idea that the court is operating at some kind of apolitical level above the fray, that's not true with this court. I don't know that that's ever been true with any court, but it's certainly not true with this court. They didn't agree with the policy. They didn't agree with the outcomes. This is an outcome determinative court. They figure out what they want the policy to be and work backwards to figure out how to make that policy legal. Right? Like that is the process. It is not the process that we were taught in school, that we were taught to believe in, that Barack Obama believed in, that the court kind of sits in deep deliberation about the law and comes to apolitical conclusions about this or that. That's not how this court operates. It's certainly not how Roberts operates, or Alito, or Thomas, or Gorsuch, or Kavanaugh, or Amy Coney Barrett. They come up with the policies they agree with, they like, and then they figure out how to make it work on the back end. Like, the deliberation is not, the deliberation is how do we make this work? It's not what should or should not work.
Right. Well, I mean, I think for some of us brought up in civics classes where the court is the deliberative, the sort of last bulwark of the Constitution, or even for some of us who are old enough to remember the Warren Court, where it seemed like the court was saving the country and pushing it in a more equitable direction, those are hard habits to break. I mean, what is the, when should the penny have dropped? What's the decision that you think nakedly revealed this as a political court in a way that only somebody who's really obtuse or writing for the New Yorker could ignore?
Bush v. Gore. I always go back to Bush v. Gore. I mean, to pull back the court curtain a little bit, as you said in your opening, I was in law school during Bush v. Gore. I was literally a 1L in law school during that fight. So when I was, you know, first being imprinted with the awesome tagline, thinking like a lawyer, I had this shining, obvious, high news story example that it was all bullshit. Right? That everything that we were learning in class was bullcrap compared to how the court was actually operating. Because if you looked at the judicial philosophies of the justices at the time, people like Antonin Scalia, people like Anthony Kennedy, if you looked at what those people had said in previous opinions, there is no way they should have stopped the recount in Florida. Right. If you go back to Bush v. Gore, what's actually at issue? It is a recount that is being authorized under state power, as Republicans love to say. States' rights was at play in Bush v. Gore. Florida had its electoral process, and it was following that process. And the Supreme Court came in from on high, from a federal level, and stopped the state of Florida from doing what the state of Florida thought best. That was in opposition to everything those Republicans had said up to that point. And the reason why they went back on their entire judicial philosophy is that they wanted George W. Bush to be president. Sandra Day O'Connor, who was part of the majority in Bush v. Gore, basically said so. Basically said, Al Gore, I don't like that guy. I mean, was part of her reasoning for voting the way she did in Bush v. Gore. So when you see that, when the Supreme Court picks the president over and above what their own judicial philosophies are, that's when everybody should have gotten the memo that this court was made of different stuff.
Okay. So it's been a quarter of a century since then. And some of us have been reluctant to come to your view.
Yes, I call those people Democrats, but...
I was going to say, I used to be one of them, but luckily, you know, my years at The Nation have eventually forced me into a more enlightened position. But for the dead-enders who still have some faith that the Supreme Court is going to finally come to its senses and stop Donald Trump, the last line that these people retreat to are that Trump doesn't always win. that he's lost a few cases in the last year at the Supreme Court. There was the removal of federal officials case where they said he couldn't remove a copyright official. There's the foreign aid case. So how do Trump's defeats, how do you explain, I was a philosophy major in college and we were taught that it only takes one counterexample. So how do you explain the counterexamples?
Well, first of all, I have two ways of explaining them. First of all, he doesn't lose on anything important. He doesn't lose on anything that he really desperately wants. And we can get in a little bit more as to why, I think, a little bit later. But he doesn't, he doesn't lose when he's trying to run for president again. He doesn't lose when he's convicted of 34 felony counts. He doesn't lose on anything that he actually cares about. He doesn't lose when he wants to ban Muslims. He doesn't lose when he wants to take away abortion rights. He doesn't lose on anything important. Right? So that's number one. On the knucklehead stuff, on the few, as you put it, counterfactuals that the Supreme Court will occasionally throw out there, you got to understand, every one of Trump's arguments is ridiculously bad. Like every single one of his legal arguments is beyond the pale of stupidity. And I do think that there are a couple of times where the Supreme Court simply, they can't swallow the vegetables, right? They're so raw and undercooked, they just can't choke it down. And even when he loses, what you'll see is that the way he loses is very rarely Trump, no, you just can't stop, right? That's never how he loses. He always loses in a way that's like, all right, idiot man. Here's what you want to do. Here's how you can do what you want to do. They will put in the decision the exact process that Trump needs to follow to get what he wants, right? Do it that way, as opposed to the ass-backwards, stupid way that you've been trying to do it up to that point. Think about how he won the Muslim ban, right? He lost the first Muslim ban and the second Muslim ban, but the court kept giving him second and third and fourth bites of the apple to eventually get the Muslim ban right? And that's been his entire history with this court. The only time this man has actually lost something important that he wanted, and the court didn't give him a second, third, fourth way out, is when he tried to steal an election that he lost, right? The 61 lawsuits that he threw up trying to recount the 2020 election, right? And I can explain that because he was on his way out the door. The court didn't have to fear him anymore when he was losing after he lost the election. They just needed to get him out the door. And so it was easy for them at that point, when Trump is functionally no longer president, to just be like, all right, no, we've given you everything you needed. We've given you everything you wanted. You lost. You lost. And we're not going to upend the entire structure of the country to allow you to do a coup. We're not going to give you the legal imprimatur of coup at this point, right? That's why he lost those cases, because he had already lost the election. Fast forward to 2024, when he looks like he might win another election, all of a sudden he starts winning again.
Well, I was going to say that for some of us, the important words in that last explanation, which I found very persuasive and also delightfully colorful, was at that point. because, there have been stories in the last week. Steve Bannon was quoting as saying Trump has a plan to run again in 2028. So, we'll see where we get to at that point. But I think the one other factor that we should at least touch on, because it's probably worth bearing in mind as we get down to cases, is the court's concern for its own legitimacy and how that colors how they rule.
Yeah, so I want to answer that question in a couple of different ways. First of all, we need to understand what the court's actual power is, right? And Don, you've heard me make this analogy before, but, in Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist 78, he says that the Supreme Court should be the least dangerous branch of government because it has neither the purse nor the sword. The purse being the power to tax. The power to tax is the power to destroy. That's Congress, right? The sword being the army. That's the commander in chief. That's the president. The Supreme Court has neither of those things, right? It doesn't have the ability to independently enforce its orders. It has to rely on the other branches of governments to do its bidding. And that's why Hamilton theorized that the court could never get too far out over its skis, over and above what the elected branches wanted, right? Because if it did, Congress wouldn't authorize the money that the Supreme Court wanted to be paid, or the president wouldn't enforce the orders as the executive branch of the country, right? The next time Hamilton would be as wrong, he'd be shooting his gun up into the air in New Jersey, right? That's the level of mistake that Hamilton made about the Supreme Court. But that's because of its view of its own legitimacy. The Supreme Court has power because we all agree it should have power. The Supreme Court's orders are enforced because Congress decides to enforce those orders, because the president decides to enforce those orders, right? And so if you're John Roberts, if you're Sam Alito, if you're Neil Gorsuch, if you've got this generational supermajority that's going to allow you to remake the country in whatever way you see fit, what's the one thing you're afraid of? You're afraid of a president who won't enforce your orders. You're afraid of a president that will expose you as the feckless thugs in robes that you are. Now, who's going to do that? Not a Democrat, all right? I promise you, Brett Kavanaugh is not sitting in his house worried about what the next Democratic president is gonna do should the wheel ever come around. The Democrats have already proven that they have neither the strength nor the will to stand up to the Supreme Court. You know who does? Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the person. Donald Trump is that guy who will look at a Supreme Court order and tell them to go jump in a lake. Like, that is in his DNA. And so if you're Roberts, the one thing that can happen to ruin your power is for Donald Trump to ignore one of your orders. Because once that happens once, again, the whole, like, the facade falls away, right? The house of cards comes crumbling down. So how do you prevent that if you're John Roberts? Well, you never give Trump an order that he's gonna want to refuse, which means you always give Trump what he wants, right? You always do the thing that Trump wants you to do. It looks to the outside eye, to the casual observer, like the Supreme Court is giving away its power to Trump. No, it's protecting its power from Trump by always giving Trump what he wants, so he'll never have an opportunity to ignore their orders, right? And they know that if they can just get through this bit, if they can just get through the Trump era, they will emerge as the most powerful branch in government. They will emerge with their power and their legitimacy still intact, because we know the Democrats are never gonna do anything to them. And the Supreme Court knows that they will outlive Trump. Trump is 80 and, you know, always one cheeseburger away from slipping this mortal coil. John Roberts is 70. John Roberts has every intention of outliving Trump. He was here before Trump got here. He's going to be here after Trump is gone. Trump might run again in 2028. Doesn't matter. John Roberts can outlive that too, right? They're not worried about, they're worried about getting through the Trump era with their power intact, because they know they have a generational power that Trump can only dream about.
Well, now that that raises some questions which I want us to get to before we finish, particularly about whether, when it comes down to it in 2028, giving Trump what he wants, which is, you know, blessing a third run, is actually, in your view, likely. But let's keep that in suspense for the end of the segment. Because right now, there's some decisions we know they're going to have to make. And the first one you flag up is Little v. Hickox. So tell us what that one is and why it matters.
Yeah, so this is a consolidated case. It's about trans women athletes, right? And it's that is an issue where the Democratic Party has decided to abandon the trans community to the slings and arrows of outrageous cis-hetero culture, right? Well, Democratic consultants keep telling us, just abandon trans people. Just leave them to be crushed by the Republican cultural machine. And that's what this case is. This case involves a ban on on trans women from participating in women's sports in Idaho, both at the high school and collegiate level. It's a flat ban against their participation, right? It's there, I think, 10, 15 states that have similar bans. Idaho was one of the first, so Idaho is the one that got to the court first. There's a trans woman at Boise State who wanted to run track, and Idaho said no. Now, the other kind of wrinkle for this law is that it's not just a case about whether or not they can compete. This law also says that if you are a trans, if you are a woman athlete and your gender is questioned by a rival, any rival who's not sure you're a girl, then you, the person who is accused, has to submit yourself to a gynecological exam to determine your gender at birth. Now, that rule does not apply to the boys. So to me, it is a straight up equal protection problem when you have a rule that says a girl must be forced to drop her pants at the say-so of a bitter rival, but not a boy, but not a man. We don't do that to the boys. We only do that to the girls. That is a straight-up equal protection problem to me. And it gets to the larger issue with trans athletes, right? Where you have a lot of people who seem, for reasons that I don't fully understand, confused or unsure. It's a new it's a basic equal protection thing. It's a basic civil rights thing. If we're going to have a rule for one gender, we have to have the same rule for the other gender. That's simple, right? So like wherever you stand culturally on trans people, I don't understand people who accept discrimination against trans people when it's so clearly violative of every principle of fairness and equality we have in this country.
But wouldn't the Democratic devil argue that what you've just said, while eminently reasonable and, you know, morally sound, takes a long time, whereas protecting women and girl athletes, which is the Republican line for what they're doing with these laws, is much simpler. And when you have a complicated argument versus a simple one, you always lose politically. Am I wrong there?
You're making a political argument about why Democrats have abandoned this community. I think that the simplest political argument is that we're for fairness and equality. Full stop. Period. End of sentence. Right? But even if I take your devil's advocate point, even if I cede the devil's advocate point that my position is somehow more complicated to explain. I don't think it is, but sure, let's say for a certain kind of person, my position is more complicated. That's why we have laws. That's why we have laws, that we don't have to take every issue of civil rights and basic fairness and equality into the political arena where it can be fought over in Budweiser ads, you know, till the end of time, right? We have a law. It's called the 14th Amendment. It says right there, equal protection for all. This law treats women differently than men. It treats girls differently than boys. It treats trans people differently from every other person. That should be unconstitutional in the 14th Amendment, and then we don't even have to debate it politically. Then it doesn't even become a cultural issue. And that's one of my biggest complaints or criticisms about this Supreme Court, is that they make things cultural issues that need not be cultural issues, that could just be legal issues, right? I talk about this all the time with gun rights, where people are always telling me, oh, the gun culture in certain places, and I'm like, I don't care. The Second Amendment says well-regulated militia right in the text. Let's just solve this as a legal proposition and let the culture sort itself out. But this Supreme Court, these cultural warriors in robes on the Supreme Court, they never let it happen that way. They never just use the law. They always want to inject culture war bullcrap into their decisions. And that's one of the reasons why the country is like the way it is.
But isn't it? I mean, I agree with all of that. And I'm glad I pushed you into saying it so clearly and with such forensic force. But I think the culture point is important to bear in mind, even when it doesn't appear to be relevant. I mean, because it's you know, your view may vary, and you are the not only the legal expert here, but the only person in this conversation with a law degree. But reading your article, it struck me that the next case you discuss, Louisiana versus Calais, is probably the most important case the court is going to consider this year. And it doesn't appear to have a cultural component, but of course, you know, once you look at it for more than 30 seconds, it clearly does. So talk about Louisiana versus Calais, if you might.
Yeah, the cultural component of Louisiana versus Calais is the whole, like, white people don't have slaves anymore, and some of them still are pissed about that, right? Louisiana Calais is a voting rights case. It involves Louisiana's congressional maps. Louisiana has 6 congressional districts. Louisiana is 30% black. It is only 56% white by, again, simple math. You know, you don't have to be Isaac Newton to work this out. You don't need a TI-87 calculator to work this out. Simple math tells you a third of the population is black. Probably a third of the congressional districts should be majority minority. That's just simple math. And that's what the Voting Rights Act required. That is, the Voting Rights Act operated, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Louisiana was sued because its initial map was 5-1 majority white to majority minority. The Voting Rights Act said, no, you need to draw a second map to make it 4-2. Right, to give black people a third of the representation in their own state. That made sense. But of course, then white folks sued. White people sued Louisiana's second majority minority district, saying that it violated their constitutional rights to be overrepresented. Right, so the white people in Louisiana are literally arguing that they should have more representation than their population demands. That is the crux of their argument, and that is the case that went up to the Supreme Court this year for the second time. This case was heard last year by the Supreme Court, couldn't reach a decision on it, which is rare, and they scheduled it for re-argument this term. And that, I don't want to get too much into the legal weeds about the procedural issues here, but there is a precedent from the Supreme Court just from 2023 where the court did, in fact, force Alabama to draw a second majority-minority district, right? Like, that is not a Earl Warren precedent. That is not a Oliver Wendell Holmes precedent. That is a John Roberts 2023 precedent that the Supreme Court is about to overturn in this case.
Well, that's what I'm wondering about is, you know, your description of this is persuasive, except that, unlike 2023, they're going to come to the opposite conclusion. So how are they going to get there, Ellie? And what is it going to mean for the country? I mean, I think the second part is more important, but I want to know the first part first.
So the key operation here of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is that it looks at the outcomes as opposed to the intent. That's the key kind of mental shift here, right? So if you draw a map that ends up discriminating against black folks, you don't have to prove why they did it, right? Louisiana can say, I don't have a racist bone in my body, right? I have tons of black friends. Doesn't matter. If the outcome is racist, then the Voting Rights Act is allowed to operate. That's how it worked in Alabama, in the 2023 case,
right,
that I'm talking about. What they're going to say in this case is that the intent is actually the important factor, right? That the black people cannot prove that Louisiana drew its map with racist intent. Because, Don, and I don't think I'm speaking out of school here, racists rarely admit to what they're doing, right? They rarely say, like, we're doing this to do some racism today. Like, that's not how white people roll in 2025, right? You know, back in the day, you know,
although Louisiana is the home state of David,
right,
Duke.
They're trying to roll it back.
If they're gonna say it anywhere, they're gonna say it in Louisiana.
They're trying to bring it back. But as Janae Nelson said, who argued the case for the NAACP, the Voting Rights Act requires neither a confession nor an admission. We're just allowed to look at the outcome of a gerrymandered situation. We don't have to prove intent. And that is the flip from Roberts and Kavanaugh. They're going to say, actually, you do have to prove intent, or because intent cannot be established, the Voting Rights Act is not allowed to operate. And when they say that, so Roberts and Kavanaugh, I focused on them because they are the two votes in 2023 that flipped from Republican. So it was a 5-4 decision with Roberts and Kavanaugh joining the liberals. Listening to oral arguments a couple of weeks ago, it looked very clearly that Roberts and Kavanaugh were going to flip back to the normal Republican side on this. And when they say that, when they force intent into a discussion of the Voting Rights Act, it will effectively neuter Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It will eviscerate it. It will make it almost, it will make it almost inoperable. Because again, the racists are rarely going to draw, you know, a congressional map and say, we're doing this for racism. And we've already seen the effects of that. This case was argued only a couple of weeks ago, but already we have North Carolina, who's not a party to this case, who has nothing technically involved in this case. Already we have North Carolina redrawing its map specifically to take away two majority minority districts, one particular black district in North Carolina. And they're not saying they're doing it for racism. They're not saying they're trying to get rid of a black congressman because that would be wrong. Instead, they're saying that they're doing it just to protect Republican incumbents. And that is that the fact that argument is allowed to be made, that we're not discriminating against black people, we're just discriminating against Democrats. The reason why that argument is allowed to be made is because of a 2019 John Roberts decision called Rucho v. Common Cause, where John Roberts basically said that as long as you're gerrymandering only to discriminate against people based on party affiliation, that's okay. And at the time, I wrote, a bunch of other people wrote, well, that just means that every time they're discriminating against black people, they're just going to say they're discriminating against Democrats. And that is what's happened, and that is what continues to happen, and John Roberts is going to make that even easier in this case. If the case comes out the way that I believe that it will, and most other people believe that it will as well, not only does it flip the one seat in Louisiana, which, remember, we are a razor-thin, the Republicans have a razor-thin majority in Congress heading up to the 2026 midterms. Flipping one seat could be the difference for all anybody knows, but if the Supreme Court rules the way it does, some analysts have said that it could flip as many as 19 seats from black to white, which functionally means from Democrat to Republican. Again, this is a malpractice. Yes, this is evil Republicans doing evil things, and we can talk about that until the cows come home. But this is also the Democrats kind of not protecting voting rights when they had the chance, not strengthening the Voting Rights Act when they had the chance, not protecting the black vote when they had the chance. The Democrats are always sure that the white working class, they're right around the corner. They're going to come back to those Reagan Democrats. They're still coming back one election away. They don't do the work of protecting the actual base of the Democratic Party, which is black voters. And they're about to find out, when you don't even have black districts, look how hard it's going to be for you to win Congress with 19 fewer black districts. Ain't going to happen.
So in this extremely depressing future, which we're about to enter, is there anything that future Democrats, perhaps with a little more feck than the current crop, could do?
About the Supreme Court? About the Voting Rights Act? I mean, like, they're...
About the Voting Rights Act, about protecting majority-minority districts, about protecting the party's actual base.
Yeah, so you basically have to restore the Voting Rights Act, right? You have to... I don't want to say rewrite it.
There's the John
right, and
there's the John Lewis bill that didn't.
This
pass.
This is the John Lewis bill that didn't pass. Exactly. Like you already had an attempt to do that, but Manchin and Sinema, for reasons passing understanding, decided that wasn't cool at the time. But yeah, if Democrats are ever allowed to hold power again, and I don't know that they will be, but if they ever are allowed to hold power, job number 1, 2, and 3 is to restore the Voting Rights Act and make it so that, you know, and you have to literally go in and, by congressional legislation, overturn Roberts' decisions, not just in this case, not just in Shelby County, which is the case from 2013 that eviscerated Section 4s and 5 of the Voting Rights Act. You really have to do something about Rucho, this idea that discrimination based on party is constitutional and okay. You have to literally write a law that says, actually, no, it's not, right? I saw on Bill Maher, don't worry, I don't watch Bill Maher, I was on a show and the clip was played for me from Bill Maher, where Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Governator, was one of his big plans was to have independent redistricting commissions, right? Like an independent party that would come in and draw state maps in a fair way that didn't preference one party or another. That's great as long as every state does it, right? Because if every state doesn't do it, then you have the situation that we kind of have right now where Democrats in states like New York kind of unilaterally disarm themselves for gerrymandering while Republicans in states like Texas and Florida did not. Right? Gerrymandering is kind of a race to the bottom. If you allow one state to do it, then it's political malpractice if every state doesn't do it, right? You end up gerrymandering as much as possible if even one state is allowed to gerrymander as much as possible. So the way to fix that is you need literally all 50 states to be on the same page, and that means you need to impose federal rules around congressional redistricting. But that is difficult with this Supreme Court, which is going to say that the Elections Clause empowers the states, not the federal government, to control how districts are made. So to really pull it all back, to really fix this problem, you don't just need new legislation, you need a new court. You need a court that's going to allow you to impose federal rules and regulations on how districts are drawn. And you're never going to get that as long as there are six Republicans in control of the court.
Okay, since we're a little pressed for time, we'll spend 5 minutes on three cases and then we'll get back to fixing the court.
All right, lightning round.
Lightning round. Charles v. Salazar.
Yes, so this is the conversion therapy case. This is the case about whether or not it is legal to practice what I consider a form of child abuse as a licensed medical professional. A licensed medical professional, that phrase has meaning, right? When we're talking about, so the case involves a Colorado ban on conversion therapy, right? This is not a ban.
Conversion therapy. Conversion therapy being, for readers who've been out to lunch for a while.
Conversion therapy is when you tell a gay kid that they're not actually gay and that God doesn't want them to be gay. If they just pray really hard and clap three times, Tinkerbell will live and you'll want to have sex with her. Like, that's conversion therapy. It's a form of child abuse. It has been shown to increase suicide rates and depression amongst LGBTQ teens, especially. It's bad. So Colorado and I think like 20 other states have banned conversion therapy, right? But not for everybody, right? If you're a priest, you can tell whoever shows up at Sunday school to just pray it away, right? If you're a regular citizen, you want to strap a sandwich board to yourself and go out on the corner and preach the gospel of not being gay, you're free to do so. Colorado and other states ban it for licensed medical professionals, right? And that should mean something, right? We have licensing restrictions on all sorts of therapies and treatments and thoughts and whatnot, right? That's how we ban snake oil, right? That's how we should be banning RFK Jr. That's how we, right? That's how we keep horse medication and bleach out of the mouths of people suffering from COVID, right? You have a state medical board that imposes, you know, universal standards on what their professionals can and cannot do in terms of treatment. This religious licensed medical professional, licensed psychiatrist in Colorado says, oh my God, it's against my religion to have these standards. And says that she has a free speech and a free exercise right to practice conversion therapy. That is the case that went up to the Supreme Court. And if you know anything about this Supreme Court, whenever Christians say they have a right to do something, Christians always win. Christians always win at the Supreme Court, regardless of what the law says or should say.
Well, I think that's, you know, what's interesting about this case is if you look at the centrist coverage, it's all about free speech. But, you know, it sounds like you think that it's going to be the free exercise of religion clause, which is the Trump, pardon the expression, card.
Yep.
For this court.
That is 100% right. And to be clear, Don, I think she has a good straight up free speech argument, right? She's a talk therapist. I can make a really good case that talk therapists should have the right to talk about whatever they want to talk about. Like, that's kind of in the job description. I think she has a great free speech argument. The problem is that we restrict people's speech and exercise of religion once they accept the medical license, right? Once you accept the imprimatur of expertise from the state, you agree to follow a certain set of rules, which means keeping your Jesus thoughts to yourself in certain situations, including this one.
Okay. A National Republican Senatorial Committee versus FEC.
Yeah, this is just Republicans want to steal more money and corrupt elections further, and the Supreme Court is totally going to agree with that because the Supreme Court is also a cabal of corrupt Republicans who like getting trips and vacations and RVs from big money donors. The legal weeds of it I am almost uninterested in the legal weeds of it, right? It's, you know, how much control a candidate can have over the dark money PACs that... You've heard this story before, but the top line is that J.D. Vance wanted to have more control over the money Peter Thiel was giving to him when he was running for Senate. And so he sued the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission, to have more control over Peter Thiel's money. And procedural back and forth over a number of years, now that case is up for the Supreme Court, and this corrupt Supreme Court is certainly going to side with J.D. Vance and rich Republican donors and the corruption of politics.
Okay. Note that down, listeners. Because if Ellie's wrong on this one, it's going to be a big deal. But sadly, I'm almost certain he's right.
That is the case that I have the highest confidence in that I am right.
That's what it's the case, sadly, that I have the highest confidence in that you're right, too. All right. And then this last one is a terrible case. You know, once again, grounds for optimism are pretty much non-existent. And that's Urias Orellana versus Bondi.
This is a man who was marked for death by a hitman, by an actual professional hitman in El Salvador who vowed to kill his entire family. The hitman's name is Wilfredo, and Wilfredo has a bone to pick with this man and his entire family, and he's always roughed up his brothers. And so after the guy saw some of the hitman's like goons casing his joint, he fled. He and his wife and his children fled to the United States. Yes, without a visa. Yes, they didn't come through the normal official way. And so obviously our government wants to send them back, right? And so he's arguing that he has a refugee right to stay here under the Convention Against Torture because he's gonna be hitmaned if he goes back to El Salvador. The First Circuit, the one that sits up in New England, said no. But the legal issue here is whether or not the ruling of an immigration judge is final, whether or not that ruling is final or whether it can be reviewed by courts. And what the Trump administration wants, the reason why this case is here, because remember, this man has technically already lost in New England. This man is going back to El Salvador, back to Wilfredo, and back almost certainly to his death. He's already lost this case. Why is the Trump administration bringing this up on appeal at all when they've functionally already won? It's because they want the Supreme Court to say that immigration judges' rulings cannot be reviewed. And you can link that up, if your listeners remember, to a story earlier this year where the Trump administration was trying to bring in JAG Corps officers, military judges, as immigration judges because they don't have enough immigration judges, or at least they don't have enough immigration judges that do what Trump wants them to do. And so you have to link these two stories up. Trump is bringing in immigration judges that he thinks are going to do exactly what he wants. And then the Trump administration is trying to get the Supreme Court to say that those rulings cannot be reviewed by a court of, you know, actual judges. That's the legal grist of it here. But I also just want to point out that, you know, when we talk about immigration, the Republicans would always have us believe it's bad people, it's criminals, it's hitmen who are coming to this country illegally. No, bro. No. Wilfredo, the El Salvadorian hitman, is doing just fine in El Salvador. He don't need to go nowhere. It is Orellana who's the one who needs to flee. It's the victim of these criminals and bad people are the ones who need to flee and come to this country. And yet those are the people that we're treating as if they're the criminals.
Right. Before we leave, I feel like, you know, yet again, we have exposed why this is a terrible situation and why even more terrible things are about to happen. But we like to end on at least a potentially constructive note here at the Nation Podcast. So
burn it down. That's my constructive note. The construction of fire. No, sorry. Go on.
And since we are the nation, we are allowed to draw on the entire rhetorical wealth of the left. So let me ask you Lenin's question. What is to be done, Ellie?
Yes. So what is to be done is clearly to expand the Supreme Court. Like, again, I've said, I think, since I started at the nation in 2020, since I started freelancing for the nation in 2019, the liberal agenda, the left agenda, cannot survive generational control of the Supreme Court by Republicans. Democracy cannot survive generational control of the Supreme Court by Republicans. Women's rights, LGBTQ rights, black voting rights, none of this survives this court if you allow it to continue ad infinitum for the rest of the natural lives of the current conservative supermajority. Nothing works. They won't let anything work. So your only real solution is to expand the court, is to bring, you know, it's the Chicago way. They pull a knife, you pull a gun, right? Like that's what you have to do. You have to bring more of your people to the party than their people. That's the only way you're going to win any of these cases and protect anything that you value. You name me an issue that you care about, whether it's guns, whether it's rights, whether it's the environment. And I will tell you, that issue cannot survive Republican control of the Supreme Court. So
how does this prescription translate when we are considering whether or not to vote for one Democratic candidate or another?
Yeah, so
what's your view of what we should ask
there? Yeah, so the first question that I'm basically a single issue voter on this at this point, Don. And my first question is, what's your plan for reforming the court? Because I don't have one is no longer an acceptable answer. I would have argued that it wasn't an acceptable answer in 2020 either, but it's certainly not an acceptable answer in 2028. What's your plan? Biden and Harris ran around talking about, we're going to restore Roe via legislation. Really? That's nice. When John Roberts vetoes that legislation before breakfast, what's your plan then? Again, to use the Untouchables. Now, what are you prepared to do? Right? If you don't have a plan to reform the Supreme Court, you're not serious about being president. You're not serious about having power. You just want the band, right? You just want the fancy house. If you don't have a plan to reform the Supreme Court, you're not serious about actually taking power in this country, because right now the power is at the Supreme Court and you have to take it from them, right? Power is a zero-sum game. Somebody has it, somebody else doesn't have it. Right now the Supreme Court has it. If you want it, you got to go take it. What's your plan for taking it, Democrats? And too many of them have no answer for that, have no plan for that. If you don't like my court expansion plan, then fine. What's yours? What's your plan, Gavin? Right? What's your plan then if you don't want to expand the court? Because let me tell you, term limits ain't it. Term limits ain't going to get you where you want to go. 18-year term limits? You think we're going to survive another 18 years with these people? I don't think so. Right. So like you need to have a plan for court reform. I also am a huge proponent of ethics reform. I feel like the Democrats during the Biden administration were handed the biggest Supreme Court scandal in American history when ProPublica came out with its report about Harlan Crow and Clarence Thomas. Democrats did nothing with that other than write an angry letter. That's not fair, Don. There were multiple angry letters that they wrote, in fairness, right? But that's what they did. This was the moment to get real ethics reform, independent third party ethics reform with teeth, forcing these judges to recuse themselves when they are compromised or biased to the litigants in their courtroom. We didn't do that, right? I always tell people, like, you know, if the Supreme Court doesn't want to do ethics reform, you cut their funding. the Supreme Court is established by a constitutional edict in Article 3. The funding is still controlled by Congress. Remember, I already mentioned Alexander Hamilton. Congress controls the power of the purse. The Constitution says that there should be a Supreme Court. Doesn't say they get a fancy courthouse, though. They can have their hearings out on the mall if there's no funding from Congress, as far as I'm concerned, right? So you start hitting these guys in the wallet. You start hitting these guys with legislation. Maybe you start hitting these guys with constitutional amendments. I don't know that that's, I think of the things that I'm talking about, the constitutional amendment is the least politically possible thing. But, you know, you got to at least threaten that. It goes back to what I said earlier, Don. Who is John Roberts afraid of right now? Having been basically the best operative for the Republican Party for 20 years, who is John Roberts afraid of? Who is Sam Alito afraid of when he's pulling up the flag on his house, right? Who is Clarence Thomas afraid of? And the answer to those questions is never a Democrat. Is never what the opposition party will do to them should the opposition party ever take the reins again. And that is why everything is FUBAR. You have partisan Republicans operating with a lifetime appointment with impunity, knowing that there's nothing that the people that they are crushing will ever do to stop them. They're only afraid of other Republicans, right? It's at that point where, like, the apex predator, the only thing that they're afraid of is another apex predator. Right? The only thing a lion is afraid of is another lion. That's where the Supreme Court is right now. And until the Democrats change that, right? Until the Democrats are just like, well, you know, I got a pack of hyenas. So let's see how that rolls, Mr. Big, big scary lion. Right? Until the Democrats change the calculus in the heads of the Supreme Court justices, nothing changes. This just keeps going on and on and on until there is nothing left of our constitutional rights.
Well, on that cheerful note,
I do have something positive. I will end on something positive, because I do think the positive thing that's happening right now is that we are in a period of Supreme Court overreach, right? I think we're seeing that with the president as well. Overreach alerts the people to the fact that there might be a problem. And I do think, you know, just put it like this, over the course, I've been talking about this at The Nation since 2019, over the course of those 6 years, I've seen more and more people start to get the message, start to get the memo, start to understand how important the Supreme Court is and how desperately we need reform to do something about it. And that is my hope. As the Supreme Court continues to overreach, every time they overreach, more and more people realize that something must be done to stop them.
Okay, well, let's hope that in our own small way we've contributed to that dawning realization. Ellie, it's always a delight to talk to you. Thanks for coming to The Nation Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.